Welcome to the home of Running Toward Evil. My name is Steve DeBoard. I'm the host of this true crime podcast. This podcast is made for those true crime aficionados who relish digging into the psyche of violent criminals, weird criminals, and deviant criminal action. This podcast is not for the faint of heart. These stories will be presented as if I had gone to the crime scene myself as the investigator that I once was, and I'll be giving insights into each investigation to try to fill in the gaps so you can understand the intricacies of each investigation. This is Steve DeBoard with the Running Toward Evil podcast. Today we have a special event for you, and it's with Eve Carson, who is an author with Genius Books. And Eve, what is the name of your book?
It's called Simple, Safe, and Secret, The 1981 Murder of Joan L. Webster.
Okay. Eve, give us a little rundown about what this is about and what your investigation is about and why, how you got started.
Joan Webster was my sister-in-law. I was married to her brother. She was a graduate school of design at Harvard. Very bright young woman. She was halfway through her curriculum, and upon returning from a Thanksgiving break, she disappeared and was later found murdered. It was a very baffling case for a long time. It is still a variety of other things. And the state did put forward a theory. I began to investigate it in 2006 because there were so many aspects of it that did not make sense to me. And I went through a process of recovering documents from a pretty broad range of locations, agencies, departments, and what have you. And as I put the pieces together, I could really see some problems why this case was never resolved.
Okay, a couple of those problems so we have at least something to get started on.
Okay. Two big problems. I think the two main areas that I focused on, I discovered that there was an eyewitness report taken by the police. It describes the man that was with Joan Webster at the airport. That lead was suppressed. I never knew about it, but I did discover in police reports that it actually had been hand-delivered to the Websters. They did have that lead in December of 1981, just a short time after Joan disappeared. That gave a description of a man that was not the same description of the man that the state began to accuse of this crime. The second component that really concerned me, the story that the state had promoted was that an individual picked up Joan at the airport driving a gypsy cab, took her to his boat, murdered her, and dumped her at Boston Harbor. That story prevailed for years. As I dug into records, I recovered the certified court records of a bankruptcy case that centered on that boat. And the boat was sunk 4 months before Joan disappeared. So it was not a legitimate explanation, certainly something that could have been detected easily with routine investigation. There was evidence at the time that the boat did not exist. And Joan's remains were recovered in 1990, buried more than 30 miles away in an entirely different area.
Joan, let me interrupt you here for 1 second. When you say there was a bankruptcy records, can you tell me whose bankruptcy records it was?
The former prosecutor who was pursuing a man by the name of Leonard Paradiso, accusing him of Joan's murder, he instigated a bankruptcy case against his suspect, a man by the name of Leonard Paradiso. And the FBI was involved. The bankruptcy case was filed against Leonard Paradiso, and it was actually moved to the state of Rhode Island because of the publicity in Massachusetts about Joan's case. So it was a case that they were definitely trying to tie and allege that Leonard Paradiso had murdered Joan on this boat, which did not happen because the boat didn't exist.
How did the prosecutor file bankruptcy on Paradiso?
He didn't file it, but he reached out to the FBI to get them involved. So it was a federal case, but it was instigated by the Suffolk County prosecutor, Tim Burke.
Okay. And did this boat belong to Paradiso?
Technically, it belonged to his girlfriend, a woman by the name of Candace Wyant. In Massachusetts, it is a titled state. She did own the title, but he was the one that used the boat. She may have been, you know, involved in a straw purchase of the boat, but she actually held the title.
Was she questioned by anyone, any law enforcement agency?
Oh, she was heavily questioned. They tried to file charges against her. She was questioned in a grand jury about Joan's case. And she was being pressured heavily. As a matter of fact, the FBI files show that was part of their strategy, was to apply pressure.
Okay, I want to go back to a little more of victimology with Joan.
Okay.
Joan Webster, that is. I'm interested in the lack of family involvement, your investigations by her family, and you were married to her brother, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
For 25 years.
And so you had intimate dealings with his family and Joan's family.
I do.
Okay. How did Joan get into Harvard in the first place? How was she active in high school and popular and all of that?
Very popular young lady, very buoyant, a very kind person. She just had a wonderful personality that attracted others to her. Very bubbly person, very excellent student. She went to Syracuse undergrad and excelled. And I'm sure it was on her credentials that she did indeed get accepted in the Harvard program. And she was doing extremely well at Harvard as well at the time she disappeared.
She never said anything about having a problem with anything or anyone, any situation?
No, not at all.
So
you would never even suspect a problem really with any of the family members. They all kind of were engaging, very socially active. They kind of were the type of people that would be involved on anyone's guest list and whatnot. Very interesting and entertaining people.
Very wealthy family?
They came from money, or George Webster, the father, did. His father owned a business and was chairman of the board of a variety of things. So yes, there was substantial money there.
Was Joan close to her family?
I would say, appearances, at least to the outside, I would say yes. They kind of appeared almost like a Norman Rockwell-type family. You wouldn't see any cracks in the surface, that's for certain. But, yeah, I would say that they were close, but this is a very tight-knit family. As I said before, it's a very patriarchal family. What George said is the way things went.
Was she close to your husband, her brother?
Close enough. We lived in different parts of the country.
Okay.
So we didn't see each other all the time, but there were regular family gatherings at the holidays, and over the summer we all got together. So yeah, there was a close enough bond there.
Let's move back for a minute. When she was in college, in graduate school at Harvard, which is very impressive in and of itself, what was she studying?
She was studying architecture. She was in the Harvard Graduate School of Design. It was a 3-year program, and at the time she disappeared, she was about halfway through.
Was she working anywhere?
She was not working at that time. She did work prior to going to Harvard. Between Syracuse and Harvard, she did work for a while in New York City. But at that time, she was not working. She was very, very involved with her studies. She was a dorm hall proctor, so she was very busy, in that regard as well, took a lot of responsibility. As I said, people really gravitated to her, looked up to her, respected her.
Did her past relationships come into play when she was an undergraduate student with the police? And by the way, who is the investigating agency?
The current custodian of this case is Essex County in Massachusetts. And that's because that is the location where her remains were finally discovered in 1990. Prior to that, there were 3 district attorney's offices that handled this case. Initially, it was handled in Middlesex County, which is the county where Harvard is, Cambridge. It was then moved to Suffolk County, which is where the majority of the investigation took place. That was Tim Burke's office. And then finally, when her remains were recovered, it was shifted to Essex County. That in and of itself kind of raised a red flag for me. So many different departments, state, local, and federal, touched this case. It was extremely difficult recovering documents because they were spread out. There was not a single repository where everything kind of was gathered together.
You know, I can tell you from experience investigating murders that when too many hands, well, be perfectly honest, when any more than my hands touched a case and I didn't have the paperwork immediately, let's say for an interview or background research, if I didn't have that immediately, I felt like being out of control with the case.
Yeah.
So having so many agencies, and from what I've heard you say and what I've read, there were over 20 agencies over the years that's been involved in this case.
That's correct. I counted 26.
That's very confusing.
A lot of places to look.
That's very confusing when that happens, to say the least.
When I first started to recover documents, Steve, I literally had to create a spreadsheet, you know, who knew what and when, and fit the different pieces into the various spots to try and connect the dots. Current custodian, when I tried to recover documents and work with them, I learned that they were missing a multitude of very critical documents. So you can't resolve a case when you don't have the pieces.
That's right. That's exactly right. During your investigation, how long was it that you started your investigation after the disappearance occurred?
For many, many years, I trusted what I was being told. I trusted the people you would logically trust, the family, the authorities. And those are the things they were telling me. I certainly didn't press to know every minute detail about what was going on. But after many years of experience with the Webster family and some distressing experiences with the Webster family, pieces just simply did not fit. When Jones' remains were recovered in 1990, I certainly had questions. Other family members had questions. Why do you still believe that Leonard Paradiso was responsible for this crime? And George and Eleanor Webster and her siblings were just firm in the belief and accusations that it was Leonard Paradiso. Matter of fact, it was the family that approached Tim Burke and supported him in writing a book that's just glaringly false on numerous points. I began to dig into it and try to recover the records beginning in about 2006 when the former prosecutor announced he was doing this book.
Okay. So did she ever talk to you during the time when she was in Harvard before disappearance about any personal matters, anything that might make you think back and think, wow, that was odd?
Nothing that seemed out of the ordinary to me. I actually spoke to her on Thanksgiving Day, just before she disappeared. She was very upbeat, very positive about school. She, at that point, was dating someone that I had known from my undergrad years, knew him before she did, and he had actually planned to visit her over the Thanksgiving break. Those plans got changed, and that visit got canceled, and she went back early to Harvard. That, to me, was another red flag. The Websters typically did not change their routines. They were very creatures of habit. Things were organized and planned to the most minute details. So that was unusual in and of itself.
Why didn't he visit her?
I would imagine that it was on the Webster side where those plans got canceled. Many people were not aware, the public was not aware, that George Webster actually traveled at some point over that weekend. So if his travel plans changed, then everyone else's plans would change.
What about her boyfriend, the man who was going to meet her?
An incredible person. Like most of the people that knew Joan, they were very upset and distraught. He actually was residing in Detroit at that time. He was very upset upon her disappearance. He was definitely not the individual that was described in the eyewitness report that I recovered. I know that when we received a call from Eleanor Webster 3 days after Joan's disappearance, that they wanted to know if I had his phone number. I don't know if they were trying to cast suspicion on him or not, but he was in Detroit.
Why was the trip for him to meet with her canceled? Do you know?
Probably because of George Webster's plans.
What did George Webster have to do with those two meeting?
Well, in a patriarchal family, what George Webster scheduled and planned is what everyone had to adhere to.
Okay.
So if his travel plans changed, then the family's weekend plans changed.
Did you find that odd?
Not as much then as I did later down the road. having more experiences with the family. You know, George just dictated everything. And you had to go along with what George said. And if you didn't, you were in the crosshairs with George.
Let's pick out some of the major events in my mind that occurred that you've talked about and wrote about. The first one being when she got back and she was at the airport and her and another unknown person, at least unknown to you in your view, and then we'll explain that.
Okay.
What happened when they met up and about the taxi cab?
Joan had traveled alone. She was seen. She talked to people on flight. She waved to a couple people at the airport. But when she collected her bags, she actually walked up and spoke to someone behind the counter in the carousel area. That, too, was a report that got suppressed. But I recovered the article and the police reports to understand what was taking place there. Joan went out to the cab line, and she engaged a town taxi. Her luggage was loaded into the trunk of a cab, and then she turned around and indicated to the cab driver that this man was with me, this person is with me. The cabbie lifted a heavy suitcase, tried to load it in the trunk, and the man got into a verbal exchange with him. He turned around to Joan, the man who had the heavy suitcase, and indicated to Joan that we don't want to take this cab. So they removed the bags and moved to another car that was in the line. That's really where Joan disappeared. That man that was with Joan that I believe is responsible for Joan's murder.
So let me get this straight. The man that was with Joan got into some type of verbal altercation with the cab driver.
Correct.
Did the cab driver say what the argument was about?
He indicated that the man didn't like the way he was handling his suitcase. And that was verified as well. A dispatcher overheard the argument and radioed the cabbie shortly after to ask if everything was all right. And the cabbie indicated that, well, they just wanted to take another cab.
Okay.
Another car.
All right. So what car did they get into or how did they leave there?
They got into a blue car. He could not identify any cab or livery markings on that vehicle. Blue was not a standard color for a cab that would be in the cab line in that area in those years. So there was nothing to really identify it other than being a blue car. Don't know who was driving it, so obviously there's a second person involved, and that's the vehicle that they left the airport in.
Did the airport have, even back then, did the airport have cameras on the outside?
No.
I remember
no video of it.
I remember years ago that baggage handlers used to have a little stand outside when the cars came in where they'd offer to get the baggage out of the cars or put them into the cars for a tip or a certain amount of money. Were there baggage stands at the location at that time?
Not that I'm aware of. There really was no other witness that came forward. The airport was not as busy as one might expect. However, it was kind of funneled into one area. The multiple carousels were not operating the night that this happened, which was a Saturday night. Sunday was the busier travel day for Thanksgiving weekend. So it wasn't as busy, but the flights that did come in were all funneled to this one carousel area. That's where everyone was collecting their bags and then going out to the cab line. Just my own familiarity with Logan Airport, there's a little bit of separation. So if there had been any individuals or luggage stands and whatnot where someone else might have observed this, they would be set back a little bit from where you actually would meet up with the vehicles,
okay,
the taxis.
Okay. Let me ask you this question about how did it come up that Joan was killed on a boat? How did she get from the airport to a boat?
According to the authorities, they claimed that the individual who picked Joan up at the airport was their suspect, a man by the name of Leonard Paradiso. Now, he was a parolee. He could not get a hack license to drive a cab, but they claimed he drove it illegally, picked her up, took her to his boat where he raped and murdered her and then dumped her in Boston Harbor. The story originally, though, as I learned going through records, was actually suggested by a Massachusetts State Police sergeant. He had visited Leonard Paradiso in jail. Paradiso had been arrested on another crime. and he suggested that Leonard had murdered Joan on his boat. That was 4 months before he interviewed a jailhouse snitch, who then repeated basically the same story that this officer had suggested.
I see. Do you know if the police, since they thought it was Paradiso, do you know if the police did any vehicle registration checks to see what cars Paradiso owned?
They did many vehicle checks over the years because Paradiso had a pretty bad habit of losing vehicles, or vehicles were stolen or claimed to be stolen, whatnot. So they had several insurance claims. During the course of this investigation, they went and recovered registrations, not only for vehicles, but also for boats. So I actually was able to recover several of the boat registrations for many of the different boats that Paradiso had owned over the years.
Right. I guess why I'm asking is because if they, it seems like, and I think this is something I would have done, I would have looked up his vehicle registrations to see what cars he had and then served a search warrant on his cars to see if I could find any blood or any physical forensic material from any of the cars. Do you think they did anything like that?
No. And as a matter of fact, they had entangled this with another case. That was the case that he was in jail for at the time. They had accused him of murdering another young woman, a 1979 murder of Marie Iannuzzi. They had claimed that he had murdered her in his vehicle. They never did the searches that they could. And about a month later, he reported the vehicle missing. They claimed, but without any evidence, they claimed that he had burned it, but never did any forensic testing on that vehicle to support their claims that he had murdered that young woman.
Yeah, that makes it convenient, doesn't it?
Yeah. Matter of fact, going through those records, which I went through very thoroughly because this was all going on together at the same time, they really entangled these cases. That young woman was strangled. Her body was found the next day. Her boyfriend was actually the logical suspect, and there was a great deal of evidence that supported him as being the culprit. But Paradiso was convenient, and his name really didn't pop up until Joan disappeared.
You had mentioned that the police used an informant.
Correct.
Tell us about this guy.
His name was Robert Bond. I actually met him face-to-face, went with a private investigator to meet him face-to-face. Very burly, very large man, very intimidating. He was a two-time convicted killer, and supposedly Leonard Paradiso had confessed murdering both the Marie Iannuzzi young woman and Joan Webster to this cellmate. They weren't cellmates, but they were in the same block. As it turned out, I found out that he had actually been moved from one section to be positioned close to Leonard Paradiso. As I said, he was interviewed by the officer who had originally suggested the boat story and surprisingly made the same claim.
Interesting. Do you know if there was a deal made? And I know he's not going to get out of jail, but perhaps for better conditions, money in his jail account or anything like that?
Absolutely. There were promises that were made to him for a lesser charge on the second murder he was standing trial for. There was money dangled in front of him. The Webster reward money was dangled in front of him. At one point in time, he even petitioned Senator Ted Kennedy and was moved to a federal prison for a little bit better accommodations. This guy got into fights and trouble all through the penal system. I mean, he was trouble wherever he went.
Wow. Getting Ted Kennedy to help him, huh, on a murder charge. Well, that's the pot calling the kettle black, isn't it?
It isn't it, though.
So what made him trust this guy? I mean, he's a jailhouse snitch. It's one of those guys that wouldn't even work in court today, because if that's the only word you've got, that's just not enough, especially somebody of his background.
And I mean, he was lying in his own case. They knew that. His word was not trustworthy. I think it was just the story that they were trying to put forward, and he was convenient. And even I have recovered his written statement. I recovered a transcript of an interview that was done with the Massachusetts State Police, and there are numerous false points in that. And one thing I learned that Essex County, the current custodian, did not have those records, which is suspect. Those are the foundational documents for accusing Leonard P. Paradiso of Jones' murder. So everything, just red flags were popping up all over the place.
Sure.
And that his statement is false. So if that's the only statement they have, he claims she was dumped in Boston Harbor. She was not.
Okay. And how do we know she wasn't dumped in Boston Harbor?
Her remains were discovered in April of 1990. She had been buried in Hamilton, Massachusetts, in a very remote area, heavily wooded. She had been tossed out in a trash bag, but it had broken open. Her skull had surfaced, and it was clogging a drainage ditch. The property owner discovered it, called the police, and they had an extensive search for several days, and then did finally discover the full grave.
How do the police explain her body showing up there when it was supposed to be somewhere in the water?
Well, that's where the story got shifted, and they claimed they went back to Robert Bond's original statements and testimony and claimed that he didn't really mean way out in Boston Harbor, but instead he meant way out, which according to them meant that Paradiso took the body off the boat, drove it more than 30 miles to a very remote area and buried it.
Wow.
It's pretty weak.
So they didn't even say the current could have washed it up into the woods.
No. And it was nowhere near a coastline where it would end up in that location.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. And I'm going to go back again. Let's go back to the plane.
Okay.
I'm very interested in this guy that was with her. Do you know if the police checked on the passenger manifest on the flight she came in yet to see who was sitting next to her?
They checked the manifest for about five different flights that all came in at around the same period of time that evening. And they called passengers and whatnot. Of course, back then you didn't have to show identification if someone would have been, under an alias on mm-hmm. the flight. One would not know that. She did speak to a young couple that was on the flight, and she spoke to a priest. I have not recovered records of the interviews that were conducted, but they were extensive. They had all sorts of people come in, the few days following her disappearance to run those interviews and whatnot. That's where the cabbie interview showed up.
I see. I find that very interesting that they're so closed on the information from some of those interviews. Now, don't get me wrong. I know as a homicide investigator that there's information that you have to keep close to the vest.
Right.
But after this many years, there's nothing wrong, and it's not going to hurt anything in court to release more information based on the fact that they have to look at, if they're smart enough, they know that what will work in court and what will not work in court. In other words, something that could taint the case or something that is really good to give to the public because we need help. And it doesn't sound like there's been much output by any of the agencies that are asking the public for help.
They are actually being obstructive. The most recent Freedom of Information request I asked, and I've been very firm in asking for documentation about the boat, insurance records, any other witness statements claiming this boat existed, anything. And I received a very, what I consider, condescending letter in response saying they have provided everything that meets the requirements of my Freedom of Information request, which amounts to only registrations. And if that's all the evidence they have other than the Robert Bond statement, which they claim what they have cannot be released because it was part of the grand jury, then they have nothing, absolutely nothing, and didn't do the investigation to find out if the boat existed.
So they're not even giving any kind of forensic report documents. If they went onto the boat to look for evidence or blood, anything, they're not releasing any of that either about what they collected on the boat, if in fact there was a boat.
They did not, and I did ask for those reports because I recovered through the FBI all of the lab analysis done on the boat after it was recovered. It was raised in 1983. It was located and raised, went through extensive testing. There was absolutely nothing that connected Joan or anything belonging to Joan to Leonard Paradiso or that boat.
And through a registration on the hull or anything like that, if there was anything left that they could view, did they run a check on it to see who that boat could belong to?
The registration on the boat was the same as it was for Leonard Paradiso. That boat was his, or his girlfriend. As I said, she was the titled owner of the boat. It was intact. It actually had a broken rudder, which is why Leonard Paradiso sunk his own boat.
Gotcha.
But he sunk it 4 months before Joan disappeared.
I gotcha. Was there a reason for that?
It had a broken rudder, and he didn't have the money to fix it, so he was filing for insurance.
I gotcha.
And the insurance was actually paid. Insurance company did their due diligence, and they paid the insurance amount on it, again, before Joan ever disappeared. He had a record. He had a rap sheet. Some of it was for truancy and a variety of things. He had an eighth grade education. He was a shell fisherman. He certainly was no saint. He was definitely vulnerable to accusations. But as I went through this, I couldn't find any evidence that he had murdered anyone, even though he was convicted of the other woman's murder, Maria Iannuzzi.
Mm-hmm.
As I went through those records, that looks to be a wrongful conviction. There were eyewitnesses that placed him at an entirely different location from where their snitch claimed he was.
Well, here's something that kind of catches my attention on Paradiso. Paradiso is a small-time thug, it sounds like. Joan is a Harvard graduate student. Does that make sense that she'd go off with a stranger like him?
Absolutely not. He was not the person that was described in the eyewitness report. Paradiso was a much larger man than the man that was with Joan at the airport. Much bigger in stature. There's no way he could have concealed that. So, but even, you know, just to speculate, you know, would she get into a vehicle with a stranger like that? Absolutely not. Absolutely. Joan was well-traveled. She was a very smart young woman. She had been the victim of a purse snatching in New York City at one point in time. So she was very heads up. The family's extremely smart, very unique background. She would be very wary of any unusual circumstance that would put her in harm's way.
This is indicative of the investigation that I see in talking to you and in reading your book that makes no sense. As an investigator who's investigated many, many homicides, that this would make any sense at all. What it tells me, it takes a lot more investigating and a lot more things to do before you can put a period at the end of the sentence on this case. And so I admire what you've done, and in looking at the paperwork that you've gotten so far is amazing. And as much as police have, what is it, like in the last 20 years, 130, 160,000 unsolved murder cases in this country. But yet they don't want to work with citizens or citizens investigators, citizens detectives, whatever they're called, as a true asset. But many times, if it wasn't for a civilian or a citizen, these murders would never be solved in the first place. So to ignore what you're doing and your tenacity at it kind of breaks my heart that they wouldn't do that. And it hurts me as a retired policeman, homicide detective, that they wouldn't give credence to what you're doing and to sit down and listen to you.
Truly. I discovered that people said one thing to my face and another thing behind my back. The response I received to the recent Freedom of Information request just was really shattering to me in some regards, other than I'm sitting with the facts on my side. But they said this was needless and a waste of resources. And I thought, how can you say that about a murdered member of someone's family? Here they have a family member, part of the immediate family during the entirety of all of this, and I'm providing documents. I'm providing certified court records. I'm providing FBI reports. I'm providing police reports. And to take that and disregard it just indicates to me that the problem is there. They're shielding malfeasance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would certainly like to hear their reasoning behind disregarding any and everything that you've said.
Absolutely. I have not gone in and said you need to, disbar an attorney the only thing I have asked of the current Essex County office is to please refute or debunk an obviously false narrative. This crime didn't happen that way. That's not what happened to Joan. And the thing that's unfortunate when individuals, bad actors in the system, put forward a false story, they are leaving other people extremely vulnerable. And the ones that are vulnerable are the people who are unwittingly close in relationship to who actually are the guilty parties.
So where do you go from here?
I continue to press. I've recently done a lengthy interview, which you indicated you have listened to. Some of it is being edited right now to add context to it with individuals' names, documents, what have you. I intend to be as vocal as possible. I am also in the process. My paperwork has been filed to set up a nonprofit called Victims of Injustice Speak. There really needs to be a place for a person such as myself, who's been impacted by a case like this, to have resources and people to turn to. The only avenue I have had, other than trying to have a voice, has been to go to the authorities who, are in control of Joan's case, and they intend to do nothing, as far as I can tell. And, someone who's wrongfully convicted, they have organizations such as the Innocent Project. They have places to go.
Right.
Someone such as myself, we don't have any place to go, but it can have very devastating impacts on our lives, which it has. I can't even begin to describe the impact that this has had. I'm most concerned for my daughters because they are left vulnerable with this, even to a point where I fear for their safety.
Are your daughters grown?
They are. They are grown, but they are influenced by the Websters. Websters have maintained this story, which, when I examined records, I looked for a couple different things. Were they deceived? Were they delusional? Were they going to stick with any story that came along? They were not deceived. I can prove from documents I've recovered that they did have evidence in their hands, exculpatory evidence for Leonard Paradiso. Delusional, I would never put them in that category. These were very intelligent people. They had a very unique background. They were part of the intelligence community at one point. George Webster held a high position with TNT. These were not dumb people. So the only thing I'm left with is they were deceitful. And it is a very secretive family. They were hiding some things.
This is also very interesting, and I hope that sometime soon we can go back into it and see where you are. Very interested in the nonprofit that you're looking into forming. I'd like to be part of that. I'd like to be part of that organization as a member or anything, because I feel the real need for it.
I welcome that. There were wonderful offices that were involved in this case that I have still been able to reach out to. The case has haunted them. I think there were many individuals who were involved who were earnestly trying to seek the truth, and the pieces didn't add up. The pieces didn't fit. Joan deserves justice. She truly does. And if justice comes with the truth, you can't cope with traumatic situations like this as someone who's gone through something like this unless you've got the facts to deal with. As hard as they might be, you have to deal with the truth. I hope I can put together a group. I would absolutely welcome any input you can offer, Steve, with a group. I really want to see if I can engage individuals to really be a support group, to really be a voice of experience, to educate, and to find ways to deal with bureaucracy when they're not concerned in finding the truth.
Eve, it's been fantastic talking to you, and I'm only sorry that we can't continue this and go on and learn more, because I think there's a lesson here for other citizens that are investigating crimes in their community or even within their family. You've created a template that would certainly be one of interest to everybody that's involved in something like this. And that might be something that we can talk about again later on in forming or formatting a template for anybody that's interested in becoming a citizen detective or an intelligent investigator to harness the facts and get things out that they feel the police aren't doing. So I really appreciate your coming on today, and I look forward to talking to you today. I look forward to it.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it so much. And, you know, anytime I can be out there and be a voice, it's one step closer.
Eve, what is the name of your book?
The name of the book is Simple, Safe, and Secret, The 1981 Murder of Joan L. Webster.
And where can people look for that book?
You can buy it through the publisher, which is Genius Books, or you can also find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I imagine it's on Books A Million. There's also a link on my website, which is called Justice for Joan Webster. Tried to make it easily accessible, you know, wherever you're searching.
Excellent. Again, thank you, Joan, and I look forward to talking to you again.
My pleasure, Steve. You have a good afternoon.
Okay, bye. This was a tragic tale of an extraordinary murder that is either a well-thought-out conspiracy, or could it have been just a solid investigation? For Eve Carson, the mystery of Joan Webster's disappearance and eventual murder is not over. Eve Carson has developed her own methodology for developing an investigation for her sister-in-law's murder, and she is not going to give it up until the truth is known. What would the truth be to Eve Carson? Well, first, where did Joan Webster's murder occur? Was it at the boat marina, in the ocean, or where her body was found years later in the woods? Secondly, did the police and the various DAs name the real suspect, or was he just an easy target to accuse? Or was Eve correct in stating that the description of the man last seen with Joan did not fit the investigation's suspect? Thirdly, was the boat really where Joan was taken? Or had it been previously scuttled, as Eve stated? She has the paperwork that says the boat had sunk before Joan was allegedly on it. If this is true, then why do the police and the district attorney say Joan was killed on that boat? And lastly, who was the last person seen with Joan at the cab stand at the airport? The questions are many and the answers are few. However, a silver lining may be on the horizon by studying and publicizing Eve Carson's book and listening to her interviews, but more importantly, will the police sit down with her and go over step by step the investigative steps she has taken and the paperwork she has been able to get to dispute their side of the investigation? Eve Carson is tenacious, and for that, I give her great credit. Let me know what you think about this very difficult case and the information you were given. Be sure to listen for the next episode of Running Toward Evil.